Welcome to episode 68 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
Hi, I'm John Hickner, also a family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hello, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Yesterday, I learned of the passing of Jack Geiger, who died just before New Year's. He was a civil rights activist and an early leader in social medicine, not socialized medicine, social medicine. I heard him speak when I was a medical student, and the person introducing him told the story about his audaciousness to write prescriptions for groceries. He had been working in an inner city clinic, and when he was challenged by bureaucrats, he replied that to his knowledge, the treatment of choice for malnutrition was food. He helped found Physicians for Social Responsibility and later the Physicians for Human Rights. These organizations each won Nobel Peace Prizes in 85 and in 88.
Thanks, Henry. That's always good to remember some of the leaders who've come before us and their contributions. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want to get all the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM every day in your email, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. You can check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can now get free CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians just for listening to us. Go to iafp.mclms.net to claim it. That's iafp.mclms.net to claim CME. So this week we're going to discuss screening for lung cancer, preventing celiac disease, and then John has a COVID POEM related to a trial of convalescent plasma. So I'll start off, and this is talking about a study that we did looking at lung cancer screening trials. And there have now been a total of 9 lung cancer screening randomized trials in the literature. And this was prompted by the publication of the Nelson trial, which was a large Dutch study and the second largest done to date. So in this case, we did the usual literature search. We kind of already knew all of the trials. I did find a couple of others that I hadn't heard about. We ended up excluding one trial because it was pretty clear that the authors didn't properly randomize. The groups were unbalanced of different sizes at the beginning of the study. They only had 1 year of follow-up, so we excluded that one. So that left us with 8 studies and a total of over 90,000 participants. They all enrolled folks with 20 to 30 or more pack years of smoking, and they ranged in age from 45 to 75 years. The median follow-up was between 5 and 10 years, and the overall lung cancer mortality in these patients varied from about 1.6% to 4.6%. So after pooling the results, persons who were screened with low-dose CT were less likely to die from lung cancer. The relative risk was 0.81. It was statistically significant. The NNT, the number needed to treat, was 251. So for every 251 people who are screened over that period of time, you prevent one lung cancer death. All-cause mortality was lower, not statistically significantly lower, but the magnitude of that change was in the same direction and the same amount as the lung cancer-specific mortality. The mortality data were pretty homogeneous across studies. We estimated an overdiagnosis rate of about 20%, which means those are cancers that would never have been detected but for screening. And that's consistent with other studies and estimates of overdiagnosis in lung cancer screening. And it's kind of in line with what you see with mammography, which is also estimated to have about a 20% overdiagnosis rate. So bottom line, high-quality screening trials showed that low-dose CT decreases lung cancer mortality in smokers. All-cause mortality wasn't significantly reduced, but at least it moved in the same direction and the same magnitude as cancer-specific mortality, which supports at least there aren't so inadvertent serious harms. The NNT is comparable to or better than that for other cancer screening programs, but uptake remains low. John, any thoughts?
Thank you for doing the study, Mark. It's interesting that another group came out with a similar meta-analysis with the same conclusions about the same time as yours. You may recall that when the NSLT trial was done and recommended screening for lung cancer, that the American Academy of Family Physicians in their official statement was equivocal because of the high rate of false positives and the incidental findings. But I think now that we know more about this and that the ones doing the screening are much more careful about which lesions get biopsied rather than just followed up, I think it's pretty clear that we should be recommending this to our patients. Certainly an NNT, a number needed to screen of 250 to prevent one death from lung cancer is really quite favorable when looking at other screening modalities such as mammography.
Henry?
Yeah, thank you. This is strong evidence, as you point out. The meta-analysis, the other meta-analysis that John alluded to and that you'd mentioned, included that one study that you thought was so biased, and yet they came up with nearly identical data. So very similar conclusions. I guess I would step back and ask, so what's the cost of this, and how much of that cost for screening would be better spent on focusing on primary prevention?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely true that getting someone to quit smoking is cheaper than doing screening with low-dose CT, which costs several hundred dollars. It's not in the thousands of dollars, is my understanding, but it's in the hundreds of dollars, certainly, to do the screening. And then you have all the follow-ups and biopsies and things like that. On the other hand, at least the data to date show that people participating in these programs aren't less likely to quit smoking. They're also not more likely to quit smoking. Certainly, I don't know that we have to choose between one or the other. I mean, I do think we need to keep working on our patients, getting them to quit smoking. But for those that don't, and including those who have quit, but within the last 15 years, screening is considered appropriate. So, and I think the Brits are starting to consider a screening program as well. They have, I think they're starting to roll that out in certain parts of the UK as well. Henry, you got a quiz for us?
Yes. So many of us, if not most of our listeners, are living in a light challenged setting at this time of year, and we have concerns about seasonal affective disorder, or at least our patients are. So this episode's quiz asks, which of the following statements about preventing seasonal affective disorder is true? A, light therapy is clearly effective. B, cognitive behavioral therapy prevents seasonal affective disorder. C, melatonin is effective. D, bupropion is effective. Stay tuned.
Huh. I'm not sure I know the answer to that one.
Neither do I.
Maybe it's another trick question. Henry likes to do that. So Henry, you're going to tell us a little about preventing celiac disease.
Yes. So this poem asks the question, does early introduction of gluten to exclusively breastfed infants prevent celiac disease within the first 3 years of life? This was published by Logan and colleagues in JAMA Pediatrics in November. And this was called the EAT trial, the Inquiring About Tolerance Study, sort of a semi-tortured acronym. It's an open-labeled study that actually looked at multiple dietary allergens. They randomized 1,300 exclusively breastfed infants, and these were infants who were living in Wales and in England. And the focus of this specific trial looked primarily at the early introduction of gluten, wheat. And early introduction meant at 4 months of age rather than 6 months of age. And the wheat that they introduced were these wheat-based biscuits, 4 grams of wheat that were introduced each week. And the brand that they used was something called Weetabix, something I'm not familiar with. And basically, they gave them to twice a week during that whole study period. There was about 3 years of follow-up, and the parents did some surveys of symptoms and things of that nature. And each of the study participants, each of the infants, were actually tested for anti-transglutaminase antibodies. And if that was abnormal, then they were referred on to a gastroenterologist for final diagnosis. So by 3 years of age, it turns out that 9 children, 6 of whom actually had symptoms, had elevated antibodies and were referred on. Now, there's a little bit of a mess in how the diagnosis was established. Some were confirmed using endoscopy with biopsies, and others had symptomatic improvement on gluten-free diets. So a little bit of mess there in terms of differential diagnosis approaches. But ultimately, the authors concluded that none of the children who were in the early introduction group developed celiac disease compared with 7 in the control group. And so that gives you a number needed to treat of somewhere around 72. So bottom line in this is that a relatively simple introduction of dietary gluten to exclusively breastfed infants, and that's an important caveat, actually seems to decrease the prevalence of celiac disease by the time they reach 3 years of age. And that actually seems to contradict previous thinking about the need to actually delay the introduction of gluten.
Thanks, Henry. That was really interesting. And, you know, an NNT of 72, you think, well, that's pretty high. But, you know, we're talking about a lifetime of gluten sensitivity and a very simple, inexpensive intervention. Weetabix is sort of the UK Kellogg's. And so they have these wheat-based biscuits that you can pour milk on them. And that's considered a breakfast food. It is similar to what people have seen with peanuts, though, where early introduction of peanuts can also prevent peanut allergy. And I think they're going to be reporting that separately with some of the other things that they're giving to these infants. John, any comments?
Yes, the EAT trial actually on peanuts has been published already. And it was the basis really for the new recommendation that kids in peanut allergy prone families be fed peanut mush as infants. So that recommendation is pretty strong and came from the same study, interestingly enough. My other comment is that in Australia, for 6 months, I was on sabbatical, and my kids just love those Weetabix.
Oh, it's the entire UK kingdom or empire or whatever. So Commonwealth, is it the Commonwealth? I think they're still part of the Commonwealth. I remember Steve Brown, who's hopefully listening to this, when Steve had hosted the course that we teach in Arizona, one time he passed out, I think they're called Bamba, which are these Israeli peanut-based like Cheetos. They're sort of peanut Cheetos. And kids eat them all the time in Israel, apparently, and apparently they have very low rates of peanut allergy as a result. So I think they were onto something. So thanks for that. Good discussion. And yeah, so let's move on. We have our final poem. This is back to COVID. John, you're going to talk about convalescent plasma.
Yes, this study was published online with New England Journal on January 6th. Prior studies of convalescent plasma have really had mixed results. It really does not appear to be effective when given to seriously ill hospitalized patients. So this randomized trial tested the effectiveness of convalescent plasma, that is high titer convalescent plasma, in preventing the progression of COVID-19 disease when given early in the course of illness to older adults. 160 adults aged 65 to 74 who had comorbidities or age 75 and older, regardless of comorbidities, with mild symptoms were randomized to convalescent plasma or placebo infusion within 72 hours of onset of the illness. So it was given very early. The primary endpoint was severe respiratory disease, which they defined as a respiratory rate of 30 breaths per minute or more, an O2 sat of less than 93% on room air, or both. So a very simple, easy-to-measure endpoint. 13 of the 80 patients, that's 16% in the treatment group, and 25 of 80, 31% in the placebo group, developed severe respiratory distress, according to this definition, which is a relative risk of about 0.5. If you take out the 6 patients from the analysis who had already reached the primary endpoint prior to receiving the infusion, because sometimes it took a while to get the infusion to them, the relative risk was only 0.4. Now, the sample size was too small to detect differences in the really big endpoints, like life-threatening respiratory disease and death, but the trend favored convalescent plasma, since only 7 patients, 9%, had any secondary endpoint in the plasma group, and 12 patients, or 15%, in the placebo group. The investigators concluded that convalescent plasma can prevent progression of COVID-19 disease in older adults with mild symptoms when administered within 72 hours. So whether it really prevents the severe disease and death, that we're not certain of because the sample size was just way too small. They had to stop the study early because the COVID incidence was decreasing rapidly. I believe the study was done in Argentina. But this is interesting. It shows another sort of a niche role for a therapy for COVID.
Henry, what do you think?
So thanks, John. This is a good study for contrast because it gives us a chance to wax on about all kinds of possible explanations. The two studies that we have previously reviewed, PLACID and PLASMA-R, were negative trials. These were sicker patients, later introduction, and the PLACID study, which was conducted in India, even though they used convalescent plasma, slightly over a quarter of the samples had no detectable levels of neutralizing antibodies, whereas in this study, they were incorporating high titer convalescent plasma. So presumably, everybody was actually getting this. And so the other differences are that this was earlier treatment, milder symptoms. But then the other possibility is that this was just a random finding alone. And so stay tuned because it is a relatively small study and probably warrants some confirmation. My last question, and I guess it goes back a little bit to my thoughts around trying to provide balance, is what are the harms and what are the costs of administration? And the harms on these, since these are often matched in terms of blood typing, we generally don't have to worry too much about transfusion-related problems, and so it's mostly localized reaction. But I have no idea what the costs are.
Yeah, I think in Argentina, they mentioned in the paper, and it's unbelievably low there. They quoted a cost of $175 per treatment. That would not be the case in the U.S. We can be sure about that. So, right, we have no idea about cost effectiveness in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I was just about to say it kind of depends on where you are. You know, as exactly what you said, in Argentina, it's going to cost a lot less than it does here. And it does make sense. I mean, the immune-enhancing treatments like, monoclonal antibodies, this convalescent plasma make the most sense early on in the illness and when you're trying to prevent progression to the more severe inflammatory phase of the illness. And then anti-inflammatory, like IL-6 antagonist antibodies and steroids, are going to be most effective later on in the more severe patients. And I think probably next time we're going to talk about the IL-6 inhibitors, which have just been there was just a positive trial released on those. So we'll talk about that next time. So I wanted to turn to something else. We did get an email from one of our listeners, Dr. Rhonda Martin, and she gave us permission to mention her name and to quote her. And I think she raises a really good point, is that in our discussions, we've primarily focused on the benefits of masking and social isolation and social distancing without talking as much or as clearly or as forcefully perhaps about the harm. So, John, I think you were going to read a quote from her email.
Yes, here's part of what Rhonda wrote to us. Here it is. This is some of the obvious fallout from the isolation and shutout measures being taken, and she mentioned several things prior to that sentence. The increased morbidity and mortality from these events will likely not be apparent for years. However, I do feel that these factors ought to be considered at the present time in order to try to find a reasonable balance between isolation shutdown and resumption of usual activities. For example, the COVID shutdown measures will likely decrease death from COVID, but will increase death from cancer, stroke, and heart disease, and perhaps even from depression and suicide. What is the optimal balance so that we can achieve the lowest rates of death and disease during this epidemic? So that's how she concludes her discussion. And I did a little bit of research to try to sleuth out some of the adverse effects that have been measured and came across a few studies from the Center for Disease Control where they did look at surveys, at least, of symptoms of depression, anxiety, and substance use pre and post pandemic, pre and during pandemic. And they found that the prevalence of symptoms of anxiety disorder was approximately three times those reported in 2019 in the third quarter, that is 25% versus 8%. And the prevalence of depressive disorder was approximately four times that reported in the second quarter of 2019, 24% versus 6%. They also mentioned that at least 13% of the respondents to this survey said that they were drinking more or using various substances to cope with COVID. So no question there are some adverse effects. It's a little bit unclear to me, though, how much of these adverse effects are due to dealing with COVID itself and how much are due to the social isolation. And I think Dr. Martin correctly points out that we're really not going to know about death and major morbidity until more time has passed and we have some better statistics. Henry, what are your thoughts?
Well, I have many thoughts. Just in terms of the quick response with regards to death, we already know some of this. The CDC data on excess mortality, last I looked at, which took us up through November, was that we had over 300,000 excess deaths, two-thirds of which were directly attributed to COVID, which means that there's still a third of excess mortality, over 100,000 deaths from other causes that are probably indirectly related, and whether that's because people are putting off critical treatment, ignoring their chest discomfort, or from other factors. The point is very well taken. You know, I think about how I opened our discussion with regards to Jack Geiger, and in some extent, our discussions have been a reflection of our perspectives and roles. We have tended to focus primarily on the care of individuals or clusters of individuals with COVID, and we have not really spent as much time talking about the balance between the harms and benefits. And so I thank Dr. Martin for pointing that out, because much of what we have discussed falls into a traditional biomedical domain where some of the other factors really maybe reflect other things such as politics and public policies. I speak regularly with my uncles in Germany, and countries that have established social and economic support systems don't seem to be having the same degree of struggles like what we have been having. They have some, but not the same magnitude. And I guess my last point is that I'll be a little bit politically snarky, is that the lack of any national strategy has frankly forced states and local approaches. And this has really robbed a lot of the intellectual capital that we might have spent otherwise to address some of the mental health and other harms of this epidemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really exposed the inequities and disparities that have always been there in the United States and that are, I think, much greater in the U.S. than in many other countries. Certainly not all other countries, but when I think about countries that have a stronger sense of social cohesion, you know, places maybe like Denmark or Norway or Germany, and you have better safety net and less income disparities, that's all being exposed here. And I think if nothing else, hopefully we can learn from this pandemic, because there will be more. There's going to be another one, right? Maybe it's COVID-26, maybe it's COVID-32, but this will happen again. And we need to learn the lessons from the mistakes that have been made and the slow and inconsistent response to this pandemic, which could have resulted in, you know, less need for isolation, shorter periods of isolation, perhaps, and, you know, other strategies like aggressive testing that could have mitigated this. So, yeah, we're still learning. And I appreciate Dr. Martin and really any of our listeners who want to email us or have thoughts, comments, suggestions, no criticisms, please send those to John Hickner at
By the way, I have to say that Rhonda, Dr. Martin, was very kind in her critique. She was very polite. So thank you for taking it easy on us, Dr. Martin.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Okay, well, let's finish up here. We've got the quiz answer. Henry, you're going to tell us the answer.
Yes. So the quiz once again asked, which of the following statements about preventing seasonal affective disorder is true? A, light therapy is clearly effective. B, cognitive behavioral therapy prevents seasonal affective disorder. C, melatonin is effective. And D, bupropion is effective. So many of us use light therapy or antidepressants, second generation antidepressants, this SSRIs, for treating seasonal affective disorder. It turns out there's actually very little high quality data on its treatment. But when it comes to preventing it, I found four separate Cochrane reviews. And so I'll talk about each of these reviews. The first one looked at light therapy, and in their systematic review, it turns out there was only one single randomized trial of light therapy. It was small, with only 68 subjects, and it turns out it was not very high quality. It compared bright light with infrared light and no special lights. The rate of subsequent seasonal affective disorder was 43, 33, and 67%, but the differences were not statistically significant because of the small size. It turns out they also were only able to find a single unblinded study of cognitive behavioral therapy versus usual care. And it turns out that over two-thirds of the subjects in either group developed seasonal affective disorder, and there was no difference in the depression severity among those who eventually developed it. The Cochrane tried to do a systematic review on melatonin, but found no randomized controlled trials. They did find a single trial of a related substance called agomelatine, and also found no difference in the rate of seasonal affective disorder or its severity. Finally, they reported three randomized controlled trials of second-generation antidepressants. Turns out that each of those looked at extended-release bupropion, and all of the studies included individuals who had had a previous diagnosis of seasonal affective disorder. And it turns out that it was pretty effective. The number needed to treat was between 5 and 8. Yeah, there was a slightly higher rate of headaches, insomnia, and nausea, but this was a relatively inexpensive treatment. Need to be serve as a reminder that this is off-label use, but the correct answer is D. Bupropion is effective. And I do want to just sort of give a little bit of a bottom line that so while there's not a lot of data, certainly paying attention to sleep, sleep quality and quantity, limiting external stressors, outdoor activities, this time of year, remember, dress in layers, prudent exercise, stay off the ice, and healthy eating are additional things that we can recommend. And so, you know, even though the evidence is limited, light therapy has a fixed cost, but not likely to cause much in the way of harms. And so, bottom line, if you've got a person who's had previous bouts with seasonal affective disorder, especially if they've been severe, extended release bupropion might be a good option.
Well, I didn't know that. And it is interesting to look at the difference between studies of treatment of current SAD versus trying to prevent it in people who've had a previous episode. So certainly hasn't been studied as much. Thank you, Henry. It's my turn to recommend something. And I just finished three novels during a week at the beach, but none of them, I would say, rise to the level of literature or art. A book I read last summer and really enjoyed does. It's called Sapiens and was written by Yuval Noah Harari. It's just over 400 pages long. And in it, he covers the history of mankind, from prehistory to the present day. It's really well written. It goes very quickly, thought-provoking, and it's really the story of how we became human. He is a seriously smart guy, and I'm also just started one of his other books, I think it's called 21 Questions, where he addresses important questions. So smart guy, worth reading Sapiens. Bill Gates recommends it as well. Thanks for listening. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians. IAFP designates this internet enduring activity for a max of 0.5 PRA Category 1 credits. They adhere to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. It's the policy of the Illinois AFP to ensure balance, independence, objectivity, and scientific rigor in all of its educational activities. And Henry and I are paid by Wiley as editorial consultants to write poems, but we're not paid to do this podcast. The URL, again, for getting CME credit, iafp.mclms.net. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.